This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Let's talk cannabis inequity in Massachusetts. Cannabis is big business, $3.43 billion as of late August, according to the state's Cannabis Control Commission. Now, businesses pay a 6.25% sales tax, a 10.75% state excise tax, and a local option tax of 3% from host cities and towns. So don't worry, in case your eyes are crossing, we are talking about more than $500 million for the Commonwealth and income for the thousands of people working in the industry. But, and there is definitely a but, when Massachusetts legalized cannabis in 2016, it was with the promise that we'd be different. We would do it with equity, prioritizing entrepreneurs and communities disproportionately affected by the war on drugs. The Massachusetts Cannabis Control Commission developed a training and discount program for interested entrepreneurs called the Social Equity Program, and also a special equity license. By all reasonable measures, that has fallen short. But a new law the governor signed in August might help. Former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson is now CEO of Apex Noir Cannabis and is a graduate of the Social Equity Program. Ty Gomes is managing partner of Greenline Business Solutions, which does the Social Equity Program training. Tito, you're here in Studio 2. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Ty, thanks for joining us. It's nice to meet you. Thanks for being on the line.
Thank you for having me.
So, Tito, I'm going to start with you. Trace this arc. Most people know you, former Boston City Councilor, mayoral candidate, regular commentator on Radio Boston. How'd you wind up pivoting to the cannabis industry?
So, one, thank you so much, Tiziana, and I'm glad I actually get to talk about my day job. In 2016, as a Boston City Councilor, I became the first elected official to back the legalization of adult-use cannabis.
This was a ballot measure, November 2016.
Exactly. And I didn't do it because I was going to jump out into the industry, because I tried to get another job in between there. But I did it because in the state of Massachusetts, in a state where having an ounce or less in 2008 became essentially a ticket, from 2008 to 2014, it's a 300. You had a 300% higher chance of being arrested for having an ounce or less if you were black, and you had a 700% higher chance of being arrested for distribution in a state that is 7% black. And so that disparity just weighed on me, and props to Shalene Tidal, Chanel Lindsay, and others who came to Rahsaan Hall, who came to visit me on this topic. After running for mayor, I got into the industry. Ty actually has helped kind of navigate some of this stuff with a large company, and ended up breaking ties with that company, and I have started my own company, and we are opening the first 7-story full-service experiential cannabis dispensary, edible factory, and bar and lounge in Faneuil Hall. And I'm really, really excited about the path that we're on.
And in a sentence, it's safe to say that path has not been easy.
All of my hair was black, Tiziana. And I've come to learn in the cannabis industry, this industry is the most highly regulated industry out of anything in the state, when it comes to what happens at CVS's and Walgreens and the products that are there. The amount of money, I like to say, I've never been married, but I heard it's kind of expensive to do weddings. If we were, in the cannabis industry, there's a green tax. So if you talk to someone about any service, it's going to be exponentially more expensive because they think you sell cannabis right now. And then in addition, once you get through the regulatory environment, it is an immense, immense amount of money in a world where you're not allowed to go to a bank and actually borrow money. Because it's illegal federally. One last piece. You also have to find a building that doesn't have a mortgage on it because of the federal illegality, because most loans are FDIC insured. So you're looking at a subset of real estate, which also means landlords have a very have very strong leverage in this space. So it is the hardest business And I've run for a couple of offices too. It is literally the hardest thing I've ever done.
All right, so Ty, I'm going to turn to you now, and I do so much tea coverage that I called you Green Line Business Solutions instead of Green Light Business Solutions. That was, yes, a complete Freudian slip there. Sorry about that. 2012, the first state, Washington State, Colorado, go legal. 2016, California, the ballot measure in Massachusetts, 2016. So it's an industry that's had at least some life for 10 years. How long have you been in the industry, and has it always been as hard as what we just heard Tito say?
I think Tito described the experience and the process very, very accurately. It is very challenging to get into the industry. It's even more challenging to find your footing and to be competitive in the industry. To answer your question, I've been in the industry about 11 years. During the medical days in California, my foot in the door was for a dispensary in Hollywood. It was called Hollyweed. And I've been very active in the industry ever since. I was able to put together a small cooperative during those medical days. And because of that, I received priority when California rolled out their rec program. I was able to get 3 licenses and put together a scrappy team. So when we talk about, the hurdles that exist in this industry, I've been through them all.
And I do want to point out you're underscoring there's medical marijuana, and we're talking about recreational marijuana, but some people have participated in both industries. All right, so Tito and Ty, sort of all at once now, for social equity program participants, for equity applicants, for those in Massachusetts where the goal was to right the wrongs of the war on drugs, access to money, networks, just hold you back, yes or no?
I don't want to curse because my mom might be listening, but hell yes, when it comes to, in particular, money. In the city of Boston, the median net worth of a black family is $8. The average, so people need to really think about this. It's over $1 million, and Ty, correct me if I'm wrong, in Boston to start a dispensary. I know that for a fact in my case. And a lot of it has to do with, one, at the local level, you have to identify a building, and you need to, quote unquote, control it through a letter of intent. You have a relationship with the landlord. You don't want to sign. So you don't want to sign a commercial lease initially, because if you don't get the license, a commercial lease would require you to be on the hook for the whole lease.
Right.
Unlike a residential.
Which could be like a decade.
Yes. Yeah, right. And so you have to identify the property. Then you have to get what they refer to as a host community agreement, which is the relationship between the business and the city or town that you're in.
And we've covered the complexities, the potential for corruption, the lawsuits, et cetera, for the last 3 or 4 years on that.
And, Boston, it's 3%, right? So there's no negotiation. It's 3% of your gross. I'm going to say that one more time, of your gross, not of your profit, but of your gross income, right? And then after that, you go to the state level where you go for a provisional license, which is your initial state licensure. And then after that, you do a series of steps in between. You'd get a final license. And then hopefully at the end, you then get a commence operations 72-hour notice. But this is, in my case, about a year and a half. And mind you, you have to make
with
payments
cash outlay. Yeah.
to the landlord in between, as well as all of the lawyers, as well as really smart people like Ty, who actually help you do the right thing and make the right decisions along the way.
And I'm going to note that the bill that was passed in August caps that 3% at 8 years, but that's 8 years of 3% gross. So, Ty, I'm going to come back to you. Here in the Commonwealth, you do the training. So we have this social equity program, which is a business development and training program for people who could qualify for equity licenses. So in various ways, whether it's income, neighborhood, experience with the criminal justice system as a result of the war on drugs, et cetera. When we hear the level of expense, obstacles, the challenge of getting money because it's still illegal federally, how does anyone ever keep putting one foot in front of another to get through the social equity program when there's that much? That's like the walking dead that you have to walk through to get to a business.
For sure. And it's not a linear process either. You know, and you heard Tito emphasize gross income. You also have to consider the fact that cannabis businesses are subject to tax, IRS tax code 280E. So profits very, very different because cannabis businesses are not allowed to write off normal business expenses, right? So it has even more of an impact, all of these taxes. And I think that that's really a huge reason to have an educational program. I think that the SE program takes a lot of heat, but imagine if you were somebody that decided you wanted to pivot, you wanted to change your life and change your career and enter into the cannabis space, and you found out that you were qualified because you are, in fact, from one of these areas that have been disproportionately impacted, and you took all your family resources and poured it into this thing and then lost it right away. You know, couldn't even get out the gate because you just didn't understand what you were signing up for. Go ahead.
Well, so I'm just to underscore what you just said, I'm going to play a little sound. We spoke with Mary Boyd in Brockton, who's a part of the social equity program. She's going to underscore what you just said, Ty.
If I could take pictures and show you all of the folders, the stuff that I've been writing down and the steps I've been taking to try to get through this program, you would not believe it. I've done so much. I've been to conventions, you know, trying to get information, trying to find things that I could use that's going to help my business. What's the purpose when I can't even find a place? I live here and I can't find a place where I live.
So that is heartbreaking to hear from an inspiring entrepreneur, Ty. We are tight on time. So what I'm going to ask you right now is, can we fix this? Is there anything we can do to fix this?
I don't know that it needs to be fixed. I'll say this, that a social equity program is not going to get every single person that qualifies across the finish line. This industry is very, very challenging. You have to have a stick-to-itiveness about you. If somebody like Tito is telling you that it's one of the most challenging things he's ever done, please understand that your lane might not be to be a business owner. You might want to get a job in the industry first and learn some things. You might want to, you know, forge some relationships before you open your cannabis business. I've been in the space for 11 years and I have incredible relationships. When I was building my facility, I literally had to work two jobs and sleep in my facility. This is the level of dedication that is required if you want to have success in this industry. So I say that not to discourage anybody, those that are meant to do it, those that are meant to take all of the steps and get hit over the head 100 times and you wake up the next day and keep going, you guys will find success. And those that step out of the race early, unfortunately, you won't find success, but that's okay. Maybe you can start an ancillary business. Maybe you can get a really good job with one of these companies.
So Ty, I'm sorry, I've got to end us there. That's Ty Gomes, who's managing partner of Green Light Business Solutions. Tito Jackson, you're coming back next week with another guest. This is the first part of a two-part conversation. Tito Jackson, but now CEO of Apex Noir, Boston's first 7-story full experiential cannabis dispensary. We'll talk more about it next week.
Thank you so much.
Ty, thank you for sharing your perspective with us today. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you guys for having me. Take care.
Another barrage before dawn. Ukrainian anti-aircraft batteries intercepting a Russian missile over the capital. One of two shot down this morning. As the assault closes in on Kyiv, 2.5 million civilians are suddenly on the front line.
The BBC, February 25th, 2022, the very beginning of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, a war that has claimed an estimated 10,000 lives in the country and displaced more than 7 million people, according to the BBC and the United Nations. One of those displaced was a college student. The war came to Sofia Tarasuk's front door during her last year at university. Her whole life plan, including a master's in Kyiv, bombed away. Ultimately, she came here to find a classroom away from conflict. She's now studying at Brandeis University on a scholarship. We spoke with Sophia this week, and I started by asking how long she's been here.
I arrived in the United States 1 month ago. That was unexpected for me, and if you ask me if I plan to do this that year, in the beginning of this year, I would say no. My plan was to stay in Ukraine, in my country, to get master degree in my country. I had a job. Everything was so wonderful. I had a lot of plans, a lot of friends, plans to travel in other countries. But, you know, everything changed in one moment.
So I want to get to that moment. And as I understand it, you're in your pajamas, you're at university, and someone knocks on the door.
Yeah, that was morning. And I heard knocking in the door in my room, and my neighbor said the war started and we need to go to the bomb shelter. And my friends and I went to the bomb shelter with any bags, documents, or water, or medicines. Just we, and that's all. We thought that that was a joke, because it's hard to understand that in 21st century we can help war.
You didn't think Russia was going to attack?
Yeah. Of course, at that time, we had a lot of news in newspapers, a lot of talking with different people that maybe, probably one day that could happen. But it was really hard to understand that one day it could become a reality.
So we've talked to a number of people who were caught by surprise that day and then sought to leave. I'm assuming it wasn't as simple as you just go back up to your dorm room, get some clothes, get your papers, jump on a bus, and you're home.
Actually, no, because at that day, a lot of people would like to go out from the capital of Ukraine, from Kyiv. So there were a lot of people and not so much transport to go out. So that was a big problem to find the transportation. And my friend and I, we found one bus and paid a lot of money for that just to go out from Kyiv. And actually, we spent more than 30 hours to go, not even to my native city, just to Lviv. It's one city on the west of Ukraine. And then my parents went from my native city to Lviv, and we saw each other there.
How long should it take to get to Lviv?
Usually, it's just 7-8 hours, but at that day, it was 30 hours.
During that process, did you feel unsafe?
Of course. And, you know, once we stopped to just to have a break because the road was really long. It was near Kyiv, near Irpin. And some people heard explosions. I didn't, but some people heard that. And it was the first time I saw panic, how people react. And that was really awful.
So you get to Lviv, your parents drive to meet you. I understand you then went back home to your home in Western Ukraine with your parents. You spent some time there in a bomb shelter. Is that correct?
We have like a small variant of bomb shelter in my house. And first weeks, every time we got alarm about probably bombing our region. So we go to the bomb shelter.
So the first time you left Ukraine, you went to volunteer. You felt like you had to get out of the country. Is that right?
Yeah. I found the opportunity to become a volunteer in Lithuania. And I spent 5 months there volunteering in one private school. And actually, for me, that was nice time just to think what I can do in my life, how I can plan something in such terrible times, how I can continue in my studying, because that was the last year of my studying in my Ukrainian university. And I finished it online. And that also was a nice opportunity for me to help other people. A lot of people around the world help Ukrainian people. And for me, that was a nice opportunity just to give back something to that people who are so kind to Ukrainians.
Was there ever a time during that period, Sophia? And we're talking with Sophia Tarasuk, who is a student here at Brandeis University, left Ukraine, was literally in her pajamas at university and had to go down to a bomb shelter on the day that the war started, and has made, I think, in all fairness, an odyssey journey since then. Was there ever a time during that period, so now you've left university, you've spent time with your parents, you go to volunteer in Lithuania, you're trying to finish your degree online, everything about what you thought was coming next in your life is uprooted. And you still have family, including a brother who can't leave Ukraine because of the policy that men between the ages of 18 and 60 can't leave so that they can be available to fight. What was your darkest night and what was your brightest night during those times?
The darkest night, I think, you know, I spent several months in Lithuania and I had to return for a short period just to get my diploma to apply for Brandeis University. So I left in my country for several days. And the most darkest period, it was when we got a message from our friends who are soldiers, and that may be on the border with Belarus. There are a lot of Russian soldiers and maybe they could attack that night. Thanks to God, everything was okay. That was just a moment, and now my family is still in my house. Everything is normal. But that moment, I was so afraid of that moment. What to do, how to imagine my life without my house where I was raised. So for me, that was the darkest period. And actually, the lightest period, it was when I got my scholarship. And at that time, I was in Lithuania. And one evening, I got a letter in my mail. And I was so happy to get this opportunity. So I bought a cake and brought this to my school where I was volunteer. And together with all children and with teachers, we celebrated that moment. And actually, for me, it's the brightest period of this year.
What kind of cake?
It was chocolate cake.
Is that your favorite?
Yeah.
I mean, okay. Applying for a master's degree, applying for undergraduate, is an overwhelming and daunting task. You have to figure out where you want to go to school. You have to find the scholarship options. There's a tremendous amount of paperwork. You have to have your transcripts, your documentation. You're in Lithuania volunteering in the middle of a war. How did you have the presence of mind to even find this opportunity?
You know, that was very hard for me to do everything to apply, but my family supported me in every step, and that's why I got enough strength to apply. But at that time, I was thinking a lot about my life, what to do, what to plan. I'm very young girl. I'm 21 years old. Everything was so nice in my life, but once it was damaged, and I need to have another plan, what to do. Even it's hard to plan, I need to have a plan. So I was trying to find something. I applied for 5 different scholarships and I got letter of exception only from Brandeis University. And I was so happy, but also at that time I understood that it was the biggest challenge for me. As I need to get my visa to go to another country in another corner of the planet without my family, my friends. But what is my other way?
Do you think you're brave?
I'm brave, but I don't have so lot of courage like other Ukrainians who are still in Ukraine and who are still do too much, much more than me, who are soldiers, who are volunteers. Yeah, I'm brave, but in another aspects.
Do you talk to your family every day?
Almost every day.
And are they safe?
Yeah, they are now in west of Ukraine, in their house. My parents, they are teachers, and they're trying to create safe space for studying for children in their school. My brother, he's a student, and he also has his job. So now everything is okay, but I never know when I can get a message that something changed.
So I picture you. I'm going to go back to that moment in the pajamas, right? On the day that the war begins, Russia invades. And you think your life is going down a path. You're clearly somebody who plans, right? And you've got this planned out. You think your life is going down a path. And a moment happens that day and your life shoots off in another direction. Is the goal to loop it back around? To get back on the plan from, let's say, February 1st, 2022? Or is your life just heading in a different direction now.
It's not hard to predict that, but I have a desire to return my country. I know that Ukrainian people and Ukrainian youth deserves to have all the best. So, and I feel that I can help.
What do you want people to understand that maybe we don't?
I want to say that our country, in the beginning of the war, has our own choice to develop and to be one of the countries who has democratic style of life. And when the war started, Russia decided to make this choice without us, to be a part of Russia or die. But at that situation, we chose another way to fight for our country. We don't want victory. We want to just have peace, and we will do as much as possible to achieve our goal.
That was Sofia Tarasuk, master student at Brandeis University, who came here from Ukraine. A Dorchester photographer is taking portraits of people for free.
It's always nice just to take photos with the family, you know? Whenever we can be together and make a memory, it's cool.
We have, but less spontaneous. So this was nice because we're always like worried about what we're going to wear. And this was no makeup in our neighborhood, casual. Nice.
That's my wife, Sarah.
And that's Dorchester resident Neil Do Silva with Sarah. His family was one of dozens who posed for portraits this weekend at the Fields Corner branch of the Boston Public Library. The project is called Beautiful Dot, and the man behind the project and the camera is Mike Ritter. Mike, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I'm looking at Neil Do and Sarah and their kids, and it is no makeup. It is in the moment, and it is beautiful. So what is Beautiful Dot?
It's a project I started. I got a grant through the city, an opportunity grant. And I wanted to get photos out to residents. I wanted to get them portraits that they could enjoy. I wanted to show a side to Dorchester, which I've lived here since 2005. I wanted to show a side which I feel can kind of get the short end of the stick sometimes. It's not talked about as much.
What is that side? Stop there for a second. What is that side?
It's lovely people. It's families. It's people from all over, but people who help each other, pull for each other. I've felt that just in my business itself. Dorchester has helped me turn out to be the photographer and the person that I am right now. So I just wanted to give back and celebrate all the wonderful people that I know and am meeting through this project in Dorchester.
So I'm gonna pick up some sound here. So our producer Andrea went to Fields Corner, talked to many people there who were intrigued by and drawn by what you were doing. This is An Duong, who's lived most of his life in Dorchester, talking about the neighborhood.
I mean, it's always good and bad happening. There's, you know, gentrification thing going on, but there's also, you know, because of that, there's a lot more services coming along. So, but the good is that it's very diverse. There's Haitian folks here, there's Caribbean folks here, there's Vietnamese folks here. It's just lots of different cultures together. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about Dorchester.
Is that what you're capturing?
Yeah. I've only done two of the 6 days so far. And there have been people from Uganda, Kenya, Vietnam, lifelong residents, Pennsylvania, myself, upstate New York. It's amazing the blend of people in Dorchester, and yet how everyone really, it all works out in this wonderful way. Everyone celebrates one another, but also helps one another. I love seeing all the different people coming out and hearing their stories and the differences, but also the similarities in them.
So we usually do this at the end, but I know there are listeners who are going to be saying, wait, there are more of these? So right now, people can go to the Boston Public Library website to find out more.
There is, hold on, if you go to mikeritterphoto.com/beautiful-dot-portraits. Maybe we can put up a link. Sorry.
Yeah, we
that.
Will. We'll put up a link on radioboston.org for sure.
We have, if you want, I can say Adams Street on October 1st, Grove Hall October 15th, Cobman Square October 22nd, and Upham's Corner on November 5th.
So why are you doing this? I mean, you've told me the why of you want to capture, but lots of people think their community is beautiful and don't do what they do professionally for free as a result. Why are you doing this? Well, why are you
Photography, freelance photography is an interesting profession. If you're busy, you're not necessarily using your skills to tell personal stories. You're kind of getting caught up in the mix of, you know, being a business person. And that's fine. That's how I'm able to have done it for 17 years now. That said, the pandemic slowed me down to almost nothing. And I was able to sit there while taking care of my daughters and, you know, think about things I wanted to say, things I wanted to do. And this was one of them that came out of it. I did a basic portrait session in the fall of 2021 called Get Close.
Which, at a park in Dorchester.
It just bring out a studio light and give people, you know, studio lighting, like a quality portrait, but off the cuff, like they didn't even know they were walking into it. So I saw potential in that project, and then I wanted to do this. And the funny thing about, you know, freelance photography is if you're slow, you start to do your work, your what you want to say with your skills, and then people can get to know you for that, and that may even influence paying jobs down the road. It's a virtuous cycle. So I was very happy to be doing a project like this and to be getting responses, to get these portraits into people's hands and into their homes. That really gives me a wonderful feeling.
So these are art. So I'm looking at a picture now of Ana Gonzalez and her daughter Annalise. We talked to her there. Annalise is 7. She said it was the first time she and her daughter had had their portraits taken.
Y además que son costosas, a veces uno no tiene el tiempo, a veces no tiene el dinero y a ver esta oportunidad de que por lo menos una persona pueda tomarte profesionalmente una foto es muy valioso.
So what she said there, professional photos are expensive and sometimes one doesn't have the time to do them. Sometimes you don't have the money. So to see this opportunity to have someone take professional photos for free is extremely valuable. That undercaptures the value because these are in the moment, they're living. You know, so many portraits are staged, right? There's somebody standing like this, and somebody coordinated their clothes like this, and, you know, you've got just the right tree in the background. These are organic and all the more both beautiful, and they tell a story. Mm-hmm. You know, she and her daughter, she's embracing her daughter's head, and they're cuddled up close, and they're Mona Lisa smiles. And that's different than what you normally get in a photo portrait.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really am not a fan. I'll take them, but I'm not a fan of the coordinated family portrait stuff. I love when people come out unprepared. There's a bit of a dance between a photographer and a portrait, a photographer trying to draw something out that they see or want in it, and someone trying to present only the things that they think that they want the world to see. And there's just these little moments where things just break apart and the person just reveals themselves, and it's not really me directing too much. It's me just being ready to take a picture, and you see it when it happens. It goes from stale to all of a sudden just full of life, and I do love that picture with them together.
So here's Jen McAuliffe. She came to have her photo taken with her niece McKenna. She said she never misses an opportunity for a photo op.
I'm the family keeper of pictures, and I have lots of great ones, and people always appreciate it after the fact. When the kids get bigger, when someone passes away, when you're no longer friends again, and you look at it from 10 years ago, and you're like, oh, wow, that picture, that memory. So, yeah, I'm the family keeper of pictures.
You can see them laughing and giggling. They've got these streamers. Now, I had like two different questions I could ask, but instead, you nodded with this huge smile on your face all the way through that. So, why? Why are you nodding so vigorously?
I mean, exactly what she said of photography, it captures a moment and how quickly we can fade into the rest of our lives. And it's still in us, but without that prompt, without that visual, in a way it's gone. And I love the way that she worded that, to be able to look back. And so I hope that in time to come, people look back over these images, remember a wonderful day out, and just some people come out for the portraits. They know that they're there, but plenty of people just walked by and just stepped right in, and it just a nice serendipitous kind of moment than, you know, captured in the photograph itself.
Yeah. So how does it work? Do people register? Can they just show up? And do you form a line? And can they buy pictures if they want more of them? Mm. How does it actually work?
For this project, they get all of the edits. They won't get the blinks and the winks and all that stuff. I take those out. But any edit that I then color correct, they get them full res.
Wait, what is an edit?
Well, so a select, like a, okay. So they get all of them. And I was pretty adamant, like, that's the way I wanted to do this. The city has paid me. They are taxpayers in the city. It feels wonderful to do it this way. So there is, the process is come show up. If there's some time to kill, you're in a library, you're going to have a good time.
Outdoor,
indoor. And that's partly why I set up around libraries to have that option. Having times just wouldn't work. So just come and show up. And then you queue up, you get signed into an app, and then we take your picture. That's the process.
Do you have a favorite picture so far?
I really liked a family. I took this weekend, the sun was sleeping, and that's the thing, like, you know, in a perfect world, like, everyone comes awake and they're ready to listen to exactly what you say, but actually the wonderful things come out of the stuff that you don't anticipate and can't control. So he was sleeping and the parents just, on both sides of him and just like made this great, I don't know what you call it, parent sandwich around him. And you could just see just a wonderful affection and love in that family. And the dad was actually not, I always like it when one person is looking towards camera and the rest are having a moment among themselves. And so the mom was just looking out the camera almost like, you know, look what I have or look what I made. You could tell once again, like, it just kind of snapped together. And it's like, oh, that's it. You know, shoot away.
Has anything surprised you so far in doing this?
I mean, it's a lot of planning to get this laid out correctly, and I wanted to do it right. I felt an obligation to, there was a lot of potential. I feel like it's working out better than I was anticipating. Just the people who are coming out and getting them the images, and I'm working with Dorchester Reporter to share the images with some of their quotes throughout the project. I really think it's nice. Like, it's rallying Dorchester. It's showing the side I wanted to show.
The project is Beautiful Dot. The photographer, Boston-based portrait event and architecture photographer Mike Ritter. We'll have the information for the remaining days on our website at radioboston.org. Mike, thanks for the project. Thanks for coming to tell us about it today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles with Bart Tachi and Andrea Perdomo Hernandez. Marquise Neal, our senior technical director, with help today from Michaela Varela. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.